He stood beneath the high ceiling of a Los Angeles courtroom on a gray morning in late 2023. The air felt thin. The clerk read the counts. Wire fraud. Conspiracy. The judge asked if he understood. He said yes. He stared straight ahead, hands clasped, the way people do when the story has run out of side doors. They said he built a cannabis empire on paper and smoke. Investors believed they were buying rows of bright green plants in Southern California. They saw certificates, crop schedules, and legal letters with confident headings. Money moved through companies with clean names. Early returns came back on time. Friends told friends. A circle grew. By the time the first complaint reached a state office in 2021, the numbers had already left the room. The question was not only where the money went. It was how a simple promise stayed upright for so long. He lifted his chin. He said the word guilty. Chapter 1. The pitch and the first door. He liked clean shirts and quiet rooms. He chose conference tables that made people feel safe. In early 2020, he began to tell a story about opportunity. California had a legal market. Demand was strong. He would show them where the margins lived. He opened a laptop and clicked through a deck. The slides were neat. The first showed a greenhouse with sunlight on the glass. The second showed buds in perfect focus. He said permits were secured. He said a county office had stamped the forms. He laid out a calendar with plant cycles and harvest dates. The numbers looked tidy. He kept his voice low and steady. People nodded. Some had watched the market from the edges and wanted a way in without the mess of soil and code inspections. He said they would not touch the plant. Their money would ride on supply contracts. He would manage the farm. They would share the yield. He used words like compliance, canopy, and vertical integration. He defined each term once. He spoke like a man who had done the drive 100 times. Deposits arrived. They came in from a retired firefighter who had saved carefully. They came in from a nurse who wanted a second stream. They came in from a small grocer who knew risk and trusted paper. Each check cleared. He sent receipts on letterhead. He sent an email with a certificate. He attached a schedule for the first distribution. In the summer of 2020, he posted a photograph of plants under white light. He wrote that the first test run looked strong. He promised a site visit once the next phase was complete. He said the insurance company needed to finish a final step before guests could tour. He said legal would want this done the right way. He praised patience. He said the best crops are not rushed. Money moved through limited liability companies with names that sounded like roads and hills. Transfers landed in accounts at different banks, then moved again. Each hop had a memo line that matched the pitch deck. The paper looked neat. The balance sheets did not raise alarms. Early funds went out to a handful of investors in small amounts that matched the schedule. The cycle seemed to work. People slept well. In late 2020, a widow from Orange County met him at a cafe near a courthouse. She held a folder of savings. He ordered water. He listened as she spoke about her husband and steady years and a wish to help her grandson through school. He never pushed. He let the silence do the work. He said she could start small. He promised updates by the 15th of each month. She signed. He folded the copies with care. He spent hours on his websites. The pages loaded fast. The photographs were bright. There were bios with neat lines about experience and a mission to build a responsible future. The site listed a phone number that rang to a soft-spoken assistant. Emails to investors closed with a short note on compliance and a promise to keep records for audits. He invited no one to the real dirt. He said the pandemic made tours hard. He said the county did not allow visitors yet. The first complaint reached a state office in the spring of 2021. A man said he could not get a tour. He said a distribution was late by 9 days. He said the person on the phone kept saying next week. The office logged the call and sent a short reply with a link to a form. The man filled it out. He attached 2 bank statements and 3 emails. He waited. He kept the story moving. He announced a second site in Riverside County. He said expansion would lower costs and steady the supply chain. He requested additional capital from early backers and offered a bonus return for those who funded within 14 days. People who had already seen money come back leaned in. They told friends at backyard dinners and in text threads. He took calls after 9 in the evening and on Sundays. He made time. He remembered names. By late 2021, the numbers grew past the point where one person can see the edges. Wires crossed paths in ways that looked normal from any single line. 1,000 here, 10,000 there. One transfer with a note that said canopy expansion. One with a note that said nutrient upgrade. The language calmed the eye. The dates looked regular. If a distribution was late, an apology arrived, and the next one landed with a little extra. Late turned into reassurance. He sent images of harvest bins. He sent a lab sheet that showed cannabinoid percentages. He said the buyers were lined up. He said the next quarter would show the power of scale. He added that legal was reviewing one new partnership, and that he could not name the company yet. He asked them to hold questions until the review cleared. He thanked them for trust. In early 2022, one investor asked for a call with the farm manager. He said he would set it up. Weeks passed. He said the manager was in the field and had poor service. He moved the call to the next week. He sent a photograph of a greenhouse at dusk. The lines looked too clean. The investor did not notice the way the shadows repeated. He wanted the story to be true. The state office logged a second complaint. A woman wrote that she had received 3 different bank routing numbers in 6 months. She said the assistant's email signature had changed twice. She asked whether the company held the licenses it claimed. The office sent a standard note. It asked for contract copies and the names of entities. It said the review could take time. She sent what she had and waited the way people wait when they have already said yes. Inside his apartment, the walls were bare. He kept the laptop open on a kitchen table. He tracked inflows and outflows on a spreadsheet. He moved money to cover gaps. He kept one column for promises. He kept another for deadlines. He told himself that the next round would clean the slate. He told himself that a real farm might be possible if he could hold the trust a little longer. He pressed send on another update. In the fall of 2022, a small group of investors met in a back room of a restaurant. They lined up emails by date. They noticed the way the letterhead changed at the bottom of one file. They compared photographs and found a corner of glass that looked identical in 2 different sites. A nephew who worked in marketing ran one photo through a search tool and found the same image on an old horticulture blog. Doubt spread. They agreed to push for a tour with a firm date. He offered a date. The night before, he wrote that a county inspector had closed access for a day due to a safety check. He promised a new date within the week. He sent a fresh crop photo. He attached a legal letter that used strong words. The investors read the letter twice. The tone gave them pause. It said nothing specific. It only sounded official. At the end of 2022, the first investor who had complained called a detective. He brought a binder. He spoke calmly. He said he could be wrong, but the numbers felt like a circle. The detective listened and asked for copies. He asked for routing numbers and entity names. He asked for the websites and the emails. He said he would take a look. The man left the binder and walked to the elevator with a slower step than when he had arrived. In early 2023, pressure built. More investors wrote to each other. A nurse who had stayed quiet for a year finally told her brother. He worked at a bank. He did not share any protected information. He only said that normal businesses do not change accounts so often without a clear reason. He said she should ask for a full set of licenses. She sent the request. He replied that legal advised limited disclosure during an ongoing review. He asked her to trust the process. He bought time with confident words. He promised a distribution on the first day of the next month. He missed it. He said a wire room had flagged a transaction for extra review. He promised the 15th. He missed that too. He sent 2 small payments to 2 early investors. He asked them to share the good news with the group. They did. It held the line for 3 more weeks. On a warm night in June 2023, he sat in his car outside a strip mall and stared at his phone. Messages stacked up in the thread labeled founders. He typed and erased. He decided to send a long note about a new buyer and a bridge loan. He said the loan would close in 7 days. He said everyone would be whole. He ended with a short prayer for patience. He hit send. He closed his eyes. Across town, the detective opened the binder again and wrote down 3 things. The names of the companies. The banks. The domains on the emails. He sent a request for records. He called a federal contact. He set a meeting for Tuesday, 9 in the morning, July 11, 2023. He pressed save. The room that once felt safe began to tilt. Friends asked friends why tours never happened. A widow called and left a message that did not raise her voice. She said she wanted to see what she owned. She said she wanted to bring her grandson. The assistant replied with a note that mentioned a sprinkler issue. The grandson read it and said it sounded thin. The story had run on trust. Now it needed proof. He told himself that one more week would fix it. He told himself that the market always turns if you wait. He chose quiet rooms and a clean shirt. He walked in and smiled. He opened the laptop and began the next pitch. Chapter 2, The Circle Tightens. The first Real crack appeared not in an account book, but in a conversation. A text message at 9:47 p.m. on a quiet Monday in February 2023. Anyone else still waiting on January's payout? It came from Marcus, the retired firefighter who had invested $80,000. Within minutes, two more messages appeared in the group chat. One from Irene, the nurse, and another from Omar, the grocer from the East Side. For months, they'd shared photos of luxury greenhouses and hopeful updates about the Riverside expansion. Now their patience was beginning to thin. The man at the center of it all, smooth, calm, always a step ahead, was sitting alone in his apartment just outside Pasadena. The glow of a single lamp fell over his laptop. His spreadsheets looked tidy, but the numbers inside were starting to hum like wires under strain. He had already begun to juggle transfers, moving money between shell companies just to keep earlier investors quiet. He told himself it was temporary, one more bridge, one more infusion, one more month. He told himself every scammer's favorite lie, that he was buying time to make it real. The illusion of order. He woke early every morning, ironed his shirts, made coffee, and opened his laptop like a man reporting to an office that didn't exist. His company names, Greensource Holdings, Everleaf Distribution, Pacific Canopy, sat at the top of folders like three clean doors hiding chaos. Each was registered under a different address, each with its own logo and web domain. He had paid a designer online to create a fake corporate compliance seal. It looked convincing enough to calm anyone who wanted to believe. When anxious investors called, he never raised his voice. He thanked them for their trust, mentioned supply chain delays and county inspections. He sprinkled technical terms into every conversation. Canopy density, terpene stability, output ratio. To a listener unfamiliar with farming, it sounded legitimate. He ended every call with the same line. The best crops take time. And they believed him. The victims. Marcus, who'd spent 20 years running into burning buildings, had always prided himself on spotting danger. But investment danger was different, quieter, better dressed. When the quarterly payments first arrived, small but consistent, he stopped worrying. He even told his wife they might be able to retire early. Irene was the kind of person who triple-checked her patient charts, but never doubted a friend's sincerity. He'd met her at a charity dinner. He'd listened more than he spoke, and that was all it took. She'd put in $50,000, her inheritance. Omar ran a grocery in Boyle Heights, where margins were tight and hope ran thinner every year. The legalization boom had looked like a ticket out. He told his family he was part of a green revolution. When the first check cleared, he hung the certificate on his store wall beside family photos. Three people from different corners of California, all drawn by the same promise. Safe profit from something that sounded modern and clean. The first complaint. A state investigator named Ruiz had seen dozens of fraud cases before. But something about the tone of the first email he received in April 2023 caught his eye. The writer was calm, polite, almost apologetic. "I might be overreacting," it began, "but the company I invested with, Greensource Holdings, keeps changing its banking details. Could you confirm if they're properly licensed in the state database?" Ruiz typed the name into the state's registry. No result. He tried the others. Nothing. A chill ran through his gut, the kind that came from experience, not imagination. Within 2 days, he'd forwarded the message to the Financial Crimes Task Force. Digital dust. Behind the scenes, analysts began tracing the digital trail. The websites were pristine, too pristine. Each domain had been registered through an offshore privacy service, hiding ownership. The farm photos had metadata that placed them in Oregon, not California. The supposed lab certificates had been lifted from a university research paper. The illusion had been built with precision. Every fake document had a small truth inside it, a real signature image, a valid address, a plausible date. That's how the good frauds work. They dress lies in fragments of honesty. The deeper investigators dug, the clearer the pattern became. Money flowed in wide, then narrowed to a handful of personal accounts. A dozen investors at first, then 50, then more than 100. Every deposit came with a promise of high-yield crop rotation. Ruiz printed the wire logs and spread them across a long table. Arrows connected bank accounts like veins on a leaf. At the center sat the same name, over and over. The pressure mounts. By June, the circle had started to turn on itself. Investors were calling one another, comparing numbers. The calm reassurance of his monthly updates began to ring hollow. Marcus drove down to Riverside County to see the farm. The GPS led him to a stretch of empty land behind a chain-link fence. No greenhouses. No signs. Just dry earth and a row of power poles fading into heat haze. He called the number from the website. A woman's voice answered, polite and practiced. "Corporate office, may I help you?" "Yes," he said. "I'm standing at your address, and there's nothing here." "One moment, sir. I'll transfer you." The line went silent, then disconnected. By the time he called back, the number was no longer in service. The wire. That same week, one of the newer investors, a software engineer named Daryl, got an email from him asking for a bridge investment. It promised double returns within 30 days. The tone was confident, even charming. But something in the phrasing made Daryl hesitate. He decided to test him. He contacted Detective Ruiz and offered to cooperate. The plan was simple: record a meeting, confirm the fraud, and capture the confession. They met at a quiet restaurant off Route 66 on June 21, 2023. The man arrived early, as always. His shirt was pressed, his tie loose enough to look relaxed. Daryl carried a phone wired for audio. The conversation started innocently: crop cycles, county permits, future expansion. But when Daryl asked about the Riverside farm, the smile faltered. "It's in transition," he said. "We're moving operations. Can I see photos?" "Soon. The harvest is underway." "Can I tour the facility?" "Not right now. Legal reasons." The calm tone cracked for a fraction of a second, and the recorder caught it. A small tremor, but enough. When they shook hands, the agents parked nearby already knew the case had turned. The unraveling. The next morning, subpoenas went out to three banks. The first account revealed a chain of transfers. Outbound wires to credit cards, car leases, and prepaid accounts. The second led to an apartment rental under an alias. The third pointed straight to his name. By July, his entire structure began to crumble. Investors flooded his inbox with demands for repayment. Some threatened lawsuits, others begged for honesty. He stopped answering the phone. He stopped leaving his apartment. The man who once thrived on conversation now lived in silence. When his assistant, an unwitting hire from a job site, quit without notice, the illusion lost its voice. Calls to the office went unanswered. The website went offline. He tried to rebuild, registering a new company under a different name, hoping to move the funds before authorities froze them. But the timing failed. Federal agents were already watching. The knock. It came just after sunrise on July 28, 2023. The knock was firm, followed by the words every fraudster eventually hears. "Federal agents. Open the door." He stood there for a moment, coffee cup in hand, eyes fixed on the sound. Then he opened it. The apartment was small, bare walls, a table, one laptop still glowing. A spreadsheet filled the screen, rows of investor names, color-coded by risk level. The agents scanned the room, took photos, and read the warrant aloud. He didn't argue. He didn't run. He simply said, "I was going to fix it." The statement. During the interview that followed, he spoke for 2 hours. His words came slow, detached, as if describing someone else's actions. He said he'd started with real intentions, that the pandemic delays had pushed him to adjust cash flow. That one lie led to another until the truth no longer fit anywhere. He said the money wasn't for luxury, it was for keeping faith alive. When they asked if he understood the harm, he said, "I thought I'd make it back before anyone noticed." The agents didn't respond. They'd heard it all before. The arrest. By the time news broke, it was already old to him. The headlines used the same words: cannabis conman nabbed, $18 million fraud, fake farms, real victims. Neighbors stared as agents led him to the car. Some took photos. One muttered that he seemed too calm. At the station, his fingerprints smudged on the glass. His personal effects, watch, wallet, pen, went into a plastic bag. He asked for water. That night, in the holding cell, he couldn't sleep. The hum of the fluorescent light above him was constant, like the buzz of servers that had once kept his empire alive. He thought of the greenhouse photo, the one he'd copied from an old Oregon agriculture blog. The symmetry of the glass, the neat rows of plants, the light falling perfectly through the ceiling. He'd stared at that image for hours back, when the plan was just an idea. He realized now it had never been about money. It had been about control, the power to make belief real for a while. The fallout. For the investors, the arrest was both relief and devastation. They wanted their money back, but more than that, they wanted an explanation that made sense. The state issued formal notices. The FBI opened a restitution process. Reporters began calling everyone involved. Marcus refused interviews. He said the story wasn't over until justice was done. Irene spoke once, in a local radio segment. Her voice was calm. "He didn't steal my money," she said. "He stole my trust." Omar reopened his store and took down the framed certificate. He replaced it with a handwritten sign, "Trust but verify." The investigation confirmed the total losses. $18 million from more than 100 investors across the state. Less than one-third recovered. The detective's note. Detective Ruiz typed his final report in late August. His conclusion was short. Fraud built on confidence is not a storm. It is a fog. By the time you realize it's around you, you're already lost inside. He saved the file, leaned back, and stared at the ceiling. Every case ended the same way. Some version of a dream collapsing under its own weight. The waiting. He waited in county lockup for months, reading books from the library cart. The days blurred into the same gray rhythm, roll call, meals, lights out. Sometimes he thought about the people he'd met, their faces on Zoom calls, their hopeful smiles. Other times, he thought about what might have been if he'd built a real greenhouse instead of a digital one. The phone in the hallway rang often. He never answered. When the guards finally told him a plea deal was on the table, he nodded. "I'll take it," he said. The cliff. As transport officers walked him down the corridor toward the van that would take him to federal court, he caught a glimpse of the sky through a narrow window. Blue, cloudless, endless. For a moment he imagined the smell of soil, the heat of sun on glass, the hum of fans in a real greenhouse that never existed. The illusion had once lifted him. Now it was the weight that dragged him down. He closed his eyes and whispered to no one, "I just wanted it to work." The guard behind him said, "Keep moving." And he did, slowly, past the hum of doors locking behind him, toward a courtroom where the story would finally meet its end. Chapter 3, The Reckoning. The courthouse in downtown Los Angeles smelled faintly of coffee and copy paper. On the morning of October 2, 2023, he was led through a side entrance, wrists cuffed, eyes steady. The hallway buzzed with reporters. The fluorescent light washed the color from everything. A marshal guided him toward courtroom 4B, where the plea would be read. He didn't look like the kind of man who could move $18 million. He looked like someone who had lost a fight with himself. The suit hung loose at the shoulders. His tie was too short. He clutched a folder that contained a single sheet of paper, his plea agreement. The line outside the room included a few of his victims, their arms folded, faces still marked by disbelief. When the judge entered, everyone stood. Cameras clicked once, then silence settled like dust. "Mister, name redacted. Do you understand the charges against you?" "Yes, Your Honor." "You are charged with wire fraud and money laundering related to a scheme involving fraudulent cannabis investment opportunities between 2020 and 2023. Do you understand the potential penalty?" "I do." His voice was calm, almost too calm. The breakdown of a scheme. The prosecution began to read the narrative aloud, dry, methodical, factual. But to those in the room who'd lived it, every line struck deep. They described how he built websites, forged compliance documents, created fake tax records, and sent periodic returns to build confidence. How he'd used images from agriculture sites to make the farms seem real. How his early success payments came from the same investor funds he was pretending to multiply. They explained how the illusion grew layer by layer. Seed money from one investor paying another, contracts recycled under new names, bank accounts spun up and closed before they could be traced. Each action sounded small on its own, but together they built a web thick enough to trap dozens. The prosecutor gestured to a screen displaying charts. Greensource Holdings LLC. Everleaf Distribution. Riverside Agronomics. All shells, all his creations. Each time the prosecutor mentioned an investor's initials, heads turned. Some victims held hands. Others stared at the table. They had believed every update, every email, every chart. They'd shown friends pictures of their farm and bragged about being part of California's future. Now, the truth unspooled under courtroom lights. The defense. His lawyer, a calm man with silver hair, rose to speak. He said his client was remorseful. He said this began as a poorly managed business plan that devolved into criminal concealment. He said the pandemic had choked legitimate startups, that desperation had clouded judgment. He mentioned cooperation with investigators, the surrender of remaining assets, the letters of apology. But the judge's eyes didn't change. Neither did the faces in the gallery. He looked up once at the sound of his lawyer's voice, but the words didn't seem to reach him. His hands stayed clasped in front of him, pale against the dark suit. The camera shutters resumed for a moment as the defense concluded. The victims speak. The court allowed several victims to make statements. The first was Marcus, the retired firefighter. He stepped forward slowly, paper trembling in his hand. "I gave you my savings," he said. "It wasn't just money. It was the life I built after losing friends in the line of duty. I thought I was being smart. You made me feel stupid." Next came Irene, the nurse. She wore her hospital badge on her coat. "You said it was about building something green, something good. You told me patience would pay off. Now my son has to work two jobs because I believed you." Omar spoke last. His voice cracked halfway through. "I never wanted to be rich. I just wanted to be part of something legal. I wanted to believe the system worked. You taught me different." Each statement stretched the silence until it felt unbearable. The judge thanked them and asked everyone to sit. The forensics behind the curtain. In a quiet corner of the courtroom, the federal agent who had traced the digital evidence flipped through a binder. Inside were snapshots of the investigation. Bank transfer logs showing the chain of accounts. IP addresses connecting his laptop to offshore servers. Metadata proving that GreenSource documents had been fabricated from older templates. Every timestamp matched the pattern of deceit. The agent remembered the night they'd raided his apartment. The walls were bare, the fridge nearly empty, but the spreadsheet on the laptop was meticulous. Every investor, every amount, color-coded by pressure level. Notes beside certain names read "delay with bonus," "avoid call," or "keep warm." To law enforcement, this was a textbook fraud, clean, patient, emotionless. But behind the data were people who would never recover their full savings. Some had mortgaged homes. Some had borrowed from friends. The sentence. After a brief recess, the judge returned with the sentence. Having reviewed the evidence and plea agreement, the court finds the defendant guilty of wire fraud and money laundering, she said. You will serve 12 years in federal custody, followed by 3 years supervised release. You are ordered to pay restitution in the amount of $12.6 million. No sound followed. The number hung in the air like a weight. He didn't flinch. His lawyer placed a hand on his shoulder, whispered something. The bailiff approached. The judge continued, her tone measured but firm. This was not a crime of impulse. It was sustained, deliberate deceit. You targeted trust. And trust, once broken, costs more than money. A murmur ran through the gallery. The widow in the second row began to cry softly. He looked over once, not at her but at the window behind her, where sunlight filtered through the blinds. It was a small square of sky. He stared at it until the bailiff touched his arm. The cost of greed. The weeks that followed saw headlines fade, but the wreckage lingered. Forensic accountants combed through what little was left. Auctioned cars, forfeited accounts, seized electronics. Every recovered dollar was split among the victims, barely scratching the losses. The story made its way into financial advisories and training seminars. The FBI used it as a case study in affinity fraud, scams that prey on trust within local communities. His name became shorthand for a specific kind of confidence, calm, clean, patient deceit. In prison, he kept mostly to himself. He worked in the library, sorting books. Some nights he wrote letters to former investors, but they were never mailed. He stopped after 10. Parallel lives. Marcus eventually took a part-time job at a fire academy, teaching recruits about endurance, physical and moral. He told them, "You don't lose your life all at once. You lose it one easy choice at a time." Irene rebuilt slowly. She moved in with her sister, worked extra shifts, and began speaking at community centers about fraud awareness. She kept the original contract in a drawer, a reminder not of shame, but of survival. Omar sold his grocery and moved inland. He said he no longer trusted anyone who talks too smooth. But one evening he told a reporter that he forgave the man, not for his sake, but for his own. "If I keep hate, he still owns something of me," he said. The investigator's reflection. Detective Ruiz, the lead investigator, wrote his final case note 6 months later. Most victims believed because they wanted to believe. The fraudster's real product wasn't cannabis, it was hope. He closed the file and turned off the light. Another case waited on his desk. Inside the cell, nights in federal custody were quiet. He shared the block with white-collar offenders, tax evaders, counterfeiters, brokers who'd fallen from grace. No one asked questions. Everyone already knew. He replayed moments in his head. The cafe where the widow signed her forms, the text threads with Daryl, the night he sat in his car typing that last desperate update. It wasn't remorse exactly. It was recognition, the painful clarity that comes when the noise is gone. Sometimes he imagined the farm as it should have been, rows of green plants, fans humming, the smell of soil. He saw himself walking between the aisles, clipboard in hand, counting real things that grew from light and care instead of lies. Then the lights in the corridor would flicker, and the dream would fade. The message left behind. When the journalist who had followed the case interviewed the prosecutor months later, she asked what lesson people should take from it. The prosecutor said, "There's always someone selling certainty. The moment you hear guaranteed return, you're already in danger." The journalist published an article titled "The Green Promise That Wasn't." It ended with a quote from the judge's sentencing. "Trust, once broken, costs more than money." The story ran for a week, then the news cycle moved on. But for those who'd lived it, the memory stayed sharp. 1 year later, by the fall of 2024, restitution checks began to arrive, small, fragmented amounts. A letter accompanied each. "This payment represents a portion of recovered funds. The investigation remains ongoing." For some, it felt like closure. For others, it felt like salt in the wound. The money didn't matter anymore. The lesson did. Irene held her letter at the kitchen table, looked out the window, and whispered, "At least it's over." But she knew it never truly would be.